the name of God, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Amen.
Please be seated. And can you hear me in the back? Is the microphone on well enough? Is it? Can you hear now? Is it on? It is on. Okay, well, I'm not going to worry about it. So I'm back, mostly. I'm not back all the way. And what a month of June it's been. I need to talk some about Haiti at some point, which was an astonishing experience. And then the shoulder surgery went well. It happened on June 11th. So I'm just about, on Tuesday, I'll be 3 weeks out of surgery. And moving my arm sort of gingerly, stretching it 5 times a day, 5 sets. And that's my rehab. So, as you may well know, first in the sermon be a few things that we're not going to talk about. And then we'll get to the sermon itself. Just as a pointer, the Old Testament lesson today features Elijah and Elisha, as does the cover art on our bulletin today. And Elijah is a pretty interesting figure these days, partly because a number of commentators are sort of trying to reevaluate Elijah. I don't know what lessons we read in the preceding weeks, but Elijah is at the tail end of a series of events where he was in a contest with the prophets of Baal, and Elijah won that contest, and then Elijah was the agent of terrible religious violence and slaughtered all the prophets of Baal, and then fled and entered into this kind of depressed, desolate heart space. And many people are saying, well, Elijah entered into that space of desolation because he really, though he was zealous for God, he fundamentally misunderstood God, and that God was not served by that violence that slaughtered the prophets of Baal. Once he entered onto that kind of path, he had departed significantly from the reality of God. And so the story of Elijah is kind of a working out of that. And it's, some people call it a text in travail. It's like it's groaning toward an understanding of God, but it's not there yet. And so just Elijah, in one of those kind of, you know, lazy mornings, just kind of pick up 1 Kings and start reading. Also not going to talk much about the gospel, although they're very interesting, very pithy sort of sayings. The one thing I would draw to your attention that I discovered during my week's reading, there's a verse that is included in the King James version of this gospel passage that has been now left out. And we know sort of the way gospel manuscripts, there are thousands of them in existence. And scholars are always poring over what seem to be the best, the most historically accurate, the most consistent versions of the gospel to try to assemble the most accurate early texts. Well, in the when the King James Bible was written, when James and John said, "You want us to draw down fire upon them and consume them," Jesus says, "No." but then the verse that the King James Bible includes is, "For the Son of Man came not to destroy men's lives, but to save them." For the Son of Man came not to destroy men's lives, but to save them. One commentator put this as the most important verse that is not in the Bible. "For the Son of Man came not to destroy men's lives, but to save them." So what I want to talk about today is Nelson Mandela. Nelson Mandela, I'm sure you've sort of been following the news, that he seems to be nearing the end of his life. And while we may, when Nelson Mandela does die, I would love to draw something, some kind of a community celebration together to honor one of the really the great figures of the 20th century, one of the great exemplars of some features of the Christian path that I think we can learn from inexhaustibly. And it's part of the reason I want to talk about him today is that I think he has been he's been a figure of more importance in my life than I am usually aware. I think it was Mandela, I probably was not very aware of him during his imprisonment, but certainly when he began to, as his release neared in the late 80s or early 90s, and he began to sort of emerge onto the world stage again, it was then that I became aware, really, of Mandela. And as I sort of realized, when I saw him come out of his imprisonment, 27 years, most of which was spent in an 8x7 cell, as a victim of a terribly unjust regime that was committed to the segregation of the races, he emerged from that long imprisonment with a face that was radiant with kindness and hope and compassion. And I saw his face, and it was, I've talked to you more maybe about my sort of St. Francis moment, reading the stories of St. Francis as a young, as a college student, and realizing whatever Francis has, I want that. And it was kind of a Mandela moment for me as well. Whatever he has, I want. Because I want to figure out what allowed him to remain in cruel confinement with hostile jailers for 27 years and come out not just intact, but a spiritually radiant being. And it was really, I think, Mandela that helped me begin thinking about what forgiveness really means and what it really means to love your enemies and how loving your enemies and forgiveness are not separate things at all. I'll say more about that. And this is, you've heard me talk about this, but forgiveness is so central to the Christian story. It is so, so central to the Christian path that we can talk about forgiveness pretty much every week, and we would do okay. That would be a reasonable expression of church. And people struggle with forgiveness. And I don't know whether it was my own imagination or whether I actually heard the words that Mandela said, but it became very clear that the secret of his not just survival, but flourishing. And how do you flourish 27 years in prison? The secret of his flourishing was the love that he extended to his jailers. And you try to imagine the alternate case, and probably the more frequently realized case, where some injustice has been done, somebody puts me in prison, and I nurse that grudge, I nurse that anger, I nurse that injustice. And I tell you, without any doubt in my heart, that if Mandela had nursed that hatred for 27 years, he would have come out of prison a shrunken, shriveled little prune of a man with his face twisted in hatred and his heart shrunken to a little lump of coal. But he didn't do that. He loved his enemies. He loved those who put him in jail. And it saved his life and it saved his soul. And I think the understanding that came upon me in thinking about Mandela and thinking about his stance toward his jailers and what preserved his soul during that had to do with, well, there are a couple of things. One, forgiveness is not a moral burden laid upon us. And we almost always hear it that way. Forgive and I'll forgive you, says God. Don't forgive and I won't forgive you. It's like God is up there somewhere looking at us saying, well, Gloria, you haven't forgiven so-and-so, so I'm going to punish you for that. It's not that at all. Not to forgive is the punishment. Not to forgive is to be sort of anchored in this place where your heart is constricting and sort of withering and being drained of all its moisture and its juice. Not to forgive is, I often call it, a foretaste of hell. What it's like for the human heart to dwell on its injury. God says, forgive others because it is the absolute, absolute key to our human happiness. We are happy as human beings only when we are loving each other. That is our spiritual destiny. Our spiritual destiny is, as human beings, to join with that deep, great energy of God that seeks the well-being of every creature. That's our human destiny. When people hurt us, they knock us off that center. When people hurt us, we withhold our love from them. And in doing so, we set ourselves against the very energy and purposes of God. And it makes us deeply, deeply miserable. When we extend love to someone, it's as if we accomplish our own healing. They don't have to do anything. And here's another thing I've been thinking about. I've been thinking that forgiveness may not have anything at all to do with the past. I think forgiveness may have everything to do with the future. And what I mean by that is, when I forgive you, and by that I really mean when I love you, when I love you under circumstances that might tempt me to do otherwise, when I love you, here's sort of what I'm doing. I'm saying, from where I stand, it seems that Sandy has been operating in a kind of a hurtful way. She's been hurtful to me, and I think she's hurtful to other people, and I think that is also hurtful to her. I pray that God touches her heart so that she wakes up to her own true identity as a child of God, and that she stops doing hurtful things to herself and to other people. And if that prayer is answered and God does touch her heart, everybody benefits. Nobody is diminished by that. It costs me absolutely nothing to extend that bit of hopefulness to even the one who has hurt me. It costs me nothing. All it gives me in return is my peace of heart. It gives me my soul back. Huh, what a bargain. Costs me nothing, gives you your soul. You extend that to everyone. Again, it costs you nothing. They don't have to do anything. They don't have to say, I'm sorry. That's completely taken out of the equation. All it means is that you extend the love of God to every person that you know. And you do it with particular attention to those people that have hurt you, because they're the people that you are tempted to withhold your love from. And you do it to your own damage. When you withhold your love from anyone, you do it to your own misery. I'm telling you the truth. When you love other people, your heart is released and you enter into what is the peace of God. When you don't, when you withhold that for other people, you are in misery, even if you don't know it. Even if you're just, you know, you're waking up at night and you're pacing and you're whatever you're doing to avoid the fact that you're in misery, wake up to the fact that you're in misery. And the secret of getting out of it is to figure out who you need to love. Figure out who you need to forgive and set them free. Commend them to God. Because, as we hear, God, the Son of Man, came not to destroy men's lives, but to save them. All we're asking is that we sort of sign up to be on that side of the fence. I want to be on the side of the energy that saves men's souls and women's souls, and let go entirely of that hope of destruction. That only is my path of misery. And the path of love